WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD. I am indeed Kevin Tachi, and yes, it is. We are at the tail end of the long Labor Day weekend. Hope you had a great weekend, and we thank you for setting your radio dial to 95.9 WATD or 1460 WBMS in Brockton. We have a great lineup, a very, I want to say, one of those talk lineups that has a little bit of everything. We'll get to our guest in a moment who is warming up in the bullpen, ready to chat with us. At 6:40, we are going to speak with Jody Jones. She is the Senior Program Director for the Massachusetts Broadband Institute. Not sure if you know this or not, but this week, I believe it's Thursday, starting in Brockton, there is going to be a statewide listening series on the internet for all, as they're going to be traveling and touring the city and touring the state and chatting with people about the internet and making sure to see if it's fair and equitable for all, or does something need to be done. So again, that's coming up at 6:40. Hour number two, we're going to speak with author Daniel Dane, and he's got a new book that's going to be out later this month called History of Boston. So we'll talk with Daniel about that. And then we close things out with the great Jerry Thornton. This conversation usually takes place every year with Jerry just before the start of the NFL season. And we get a little bit of a little flavor from him. What did he have a chance to see during the preseason, you know, the ebb and the flow of the cuts that just happened a couple of days ago? You know, what are his thoughts on that? And what does he foresee the team, how it's going to do this year with Mac Jones having a Bill O'Brien as an offensive coordinator and some new faces that are going to be hopefully scoring, and, of course, a new faces on the defensive side of the ball who hopefully will keep the other team from scoring as well. So that's coming up at 7:30. But right now, we have a gentleman. He was on a couple of weeks ago. Actually, it might be about a month ago. He is a selectman in the town of Whitman, and we had a chance to speak with him about the news that Peaceful Meadows, this is a staple on the South Shore when it comes to ice cream, or if you maybe it's the place that you go to around the holidays for your favorite eggnog, Peaceful Meadows, up for sale. Well, just last week, they held an auction to sell the property to whoever, the highest bidder. And I guess there were multiple properties. This, I believe, included the ice cream stand, the farm. There was some 55 acres of land, and there was some residential property across the way. Justin Evans chatted with us about that, and he actually is joining us right now as our first guest. Justin, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you? How's it going, Kevin?
Pretty good. So, you know, when it comes to Labor Day, do you have a tradition when it comes to Labor Day? Are you somebody who maybe back in the day as a kid watched the Jerry Lewis telethon, or does your family like go down to the Cape and enjoy, you know, the last few hours of summer?
You know, Labor Day weekend, we typically do a Sunday cookout at my parents' house. My you know, dad is still a working paramedic, so he tends to work Mondays. So even these long weekends, he's working. But, going back as far as I can remember, we've been doing staying pretty local and doing a Sunday cookout.
And, you know, interesting enough, as I teased it, you were our kind of our eyes and ears, kind of giving us your thoughts about the sale of Peaceful Meadows. There was a lot of, if folks don't remember, podcast is up. Go to the homepage, 959watd.com, look for Podcaster. Just search for Monday Night Talk on the Podbean website to hear Justin and his thoughts. Leading up to last Thursday, I believe, or was it Wednesday? It might have been Wednesday or Thursday. Talk to me about leading up to it, and did you have a chance to go to Peaceful Meadows or have conversations with residents in the community in regards to the upcoming sale?
So, yeah, I mean, even going back to the podcast we recorded, I told you that I was looking at a couple of different options for the town leading up to the sale if it were to sell to someone who is not going to be using it as a farm. So that continued right up until the day of the auction. And we started hearing, rumors that John Hornstra over Norwell might be interested. He requested a meeting with a couple of town officials, myself, the town administrator, the assistant town administrator, just to kind of say that he was interested. However, if he got it, he was hoping to seek an agricultural preservation restriction for non-land use nerds out there. It would sort of permanently restrict the farmland to be used as a farm. Shortly after that discussion where he would have needed the town to sign on to that. And that was kind of one of his hopeful financing options. We found out shortly after that was not an eligible property. It's, I think it's too wet. So that was off the table and I, started to lose a little hope that he was going to be able to pull this one off. And the rumors were around that there were solar developers interested and potentially some commercial, sort of those same steel buildings you see down Route 18 now, some of those developers were interested. So, but there was a lot of hope that John Hornstra was going to be able to pull it off. So that was the sort of the lead up. And I know that I personally went to Peaceful Meadows those last 2 weeks, probably 8 times to make sure that I got my last ice cream in, not knowing when it was going to come.
And what was it like as far as flavors? I mean, were all the good flavors dwindled down to just a mere few? Like, I think one of your final posts before they ended up closing was that they only had like vanilla left, and it was sparse picking. It's almost like when a store is going out of business and they start out with 20 or 30% off, and when they get to 70 or 80% off, it's mere pickings, and there's not much meat on the bone per se.
Yeah, so you saw them slowly dwindle. The limited flavors went out a couple of probably about a week before the auction, and then the Friday before the auction, I went for what ended up being my last time there, and I was there probably 4 p.m. and there was just vanilla left. So I brought my daughter. I got one last vanilla frap. She got a cone, and took a couple pictures out in front and kind of said our goodbye.
Were there other people there as well with you, and did you have a chance to kind of did? Usually when you're standing in line, you hear the different conversations. And I would think that if you were there with other customers that, whether they're not so much their personal business, but anything that might have had to do with their last chance to get, something created by the folks who own Peaceful Meadows.
Yeah, it's that was kind of the whole sentiment there. I actually ran into firefighter Scott Biggins, both buying ice cream at the time. And he grew up in Whitman. So just talking about how we both had the same memories of coming here when there were cows. It was really hard to say goodbye to it.
So the day of the auction, I believe was it a late morning auction?
Yeah, it was 11 a.m. was when the auction was scheduled to start. I got there at about 11:30.
Right. And I inaccurately mentioned Wednesday or Thursday. Actually, that's when the news started breaking. I believe the auction was technically on Tuesday morning at 11.
The auction was Tuesday. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you decide to show up. Were you one of the first ones there? And did you start seeing a crowd gather, whether it's people who were interested in purchasing or just kind of, people who wanted to see what ended up happening?
No, I actually got there a little late, and I'm glad I did, because as I pulled up, you can get into the parking lot, and just the value of the cars, of each individual car, this did not look like a bunch of farmers looking up to buy a farm. This was you know, Maseratis, Aston Martins, some pretty high-end Mercedes parked there, and I thought, this may not go well for us.
So, I mean, how many were there a lot of people there with bidding paddles or who had tags that, you know, that they had registered for in advance to be able to partake in the sale?
There were probably 10 or 15 people actively participating and maybe 30 that had taken out. It was like a sheet, not really a paddle, but had prepared to make bids. And then there was a very large crowd of people there just to observe. You know, I was up there, ran into the town assessor, the town administrator. We kind of gathered together to figure out what was going to happen here and if we needed to really learn those right of first refusal rules. You know, ran into the deputy police chief, the fire chief, members of different various boards in town. So there was just a general interest from people involved. And then, you know, on Facebook, I would see afterwards people that I knew that were there that I didn't even see. So it was a big enough crowd that you'd lose track of your own friends.
And what was the first thing that went up for bid? Do you recall? Were you able to hear?
Yeah. So I showed up when the first bidding started. I missed all of the rules, so I had to try to catch up and see how it was going down. But the way they structured the auction was that they would bid on the commercial space first, the actual ice cream stand, the barn, the house, and then they would bid on the farm and then open up the bid for the combined property. So you do the same, you run through the process again, starting at what would be the sum of those two winning bids and see if anyone would bid more to get the entire space.
Ooh, that's clever.
And then they duplicated the process across the street where you did one of the homes, the second home, and then a third auction for the combined two properties.
That's a very interesting process to go through. You would think in anything that anytime that we've watched anything on, you know, TV, you know, a movie or a TV show, it's, you know, it sounds to me as though it doesn't play out the same. And then, you know, that the rules of auctioning is much different when it comes to property, especially if it's, you know, the businesses themselves and knowing that there's, you know, folks have different interests. So what was the first couple of bids like watching and seeing as, you know, you're seeing the winning bid for, you know, the first piece of commercial space, the second, what was that like for you?
It was nerve wracking. It jumped in really quickly. And, you know, starting with just the commercial space, we went in a couple of lower bids. John Hornstra was actively participating in those ones. And so it was a little bit of a relief to see that beginning. Although, you know, some other local, really people that I didn't recognize, were jumping in on it too. And he actually, so John Hornstra did win the bid for that first piece, just the commercial property. The winning bid was about $800,000, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So big sigh of relief there. And at that point, I think I pulled the town administrator aside and said, okay, if the farm goes to somebody else, we can exercise the right of first refusal so long as they don't intend to keep it a farm. And we could have an ice cream stand and conserve the open space.
Very nice.
So that was when you started to feel a little bit of the relief. Then the 55 acre comes up for auction and it went sort of the same back and forth, a couple of different people. I didn't see John Hornstra participating in that one, I think with the intent that he was going to probably have to jump in on the entirety at the end and bid on the combined properties. He may have put a couple of bids in for the farm, but I was kind of looking around everywhere else. But that one would have sold for $600,000 and went to somebody that I didn't recognize.
Okay.
And I don't know if there were names thrown out in the beginning where I missed that part, but some unknown bidder. And then luckily, we get around to that third, you know, combined property auction, and this has now been pretty well publicized, but John Hornstra did win it at $1.75 million. And when he got to the $1.5 million mark, I just kind of looked over, and he had moved over to stand by his son, looking a little nervous, kind of doing that double glance, do we push on, do we try to really win this?
Mm.
And then, you know, ultimately he did, he push past, I think, what was his comfort level. That was, seems like $1.5 million was where he was willing to go, and did win the auction. And I think he'd had 1.6, someone jumped to 1.7, and he hesitated before asking, can I go 1.75 to the auctioneer? It was going up in generally $100,000 increments, and he split the difference there.
It's interesting.
So that was a, yeah, it was a huge sigh of relief.
Right. And so, and you know, I've seen it, you know, quoted, local newspapers mentioning where he basically said that his emotions got into it. I mean, unilaterally, all the media outlets, he kind of said the same thing, that his, you know, he was kind of bidding more with his heart than he was with, you know, his wallet per se, because he realized how special and how unique this plot of land, and knowing that he's going to be able to do something, do something special, even though it's probably going to cost him even more to kind of bring things back up to speed, that there's probably going to be some need for repairs and to kind of bring things to up to code, when it comes to local ordinances and stuff.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up actually having to spend more money to get everything up to a sort of modern operating farm. Even more than that, yeah, more than he spent to purchase it.
So now, what? And now, do we care about the residential? I mean, did you have a chance to kind of follow that? And did that come with a land? Additional land? Is this a possibility that could be converted into housing, or what became of that those residential properties? Do we know?
Yeah, so that's an interesting story. This one's been less widely reported. So in the middle of bidding on the farm, a small group of women, I think it was about four women, showed up with a bank check and registered for the auction. And they seemed like less experienced auctioneers or whatever, auction participants, but did win the combined properties across the street. So that's about 6 acres combined, two homes, and it collectively went for, I think it was $735,000. The auctioneer placed a 10% fee on top of that, so they spent just shy of $1 million for two homes. I think one's a two-family, one's a single-family, and 6 acres of land. So, I mean, just ballpark Whitman prices, it's actually a pretty good deal if they're in decent shape. But it was a strange, you know, I don't think anybody at the auction knew who they were. They showed up late and won, at least for the two residential properties across the street.
And then it's probably unknown whether it's something that they're going to, you know, keep as is, or is it, you know, is there any story there at all other than they were able to buy them, you know, combined or purchase them combined?
Yeah, that remains a mystery to me, at least right now.
All right. Oh, I guess folks will have to pay attention to their local planning and zoning boards in case those addresses come up for any possible construction or any changes that may happen to that 6 acres of land. So talk to me. And did you have a chance to talk to the new owners, or has anybody in town had a chance to talk with them and get acclimated with them?
Yeah. So they, immediately after the auction, that entire crowd of people sort of one by one congratulated him, shook his hand, thanked him for stepping in and saving this farm. It was a really, you could tell that was the emotions that was getting to him, you know, kind of, do I want to extend myself a little bit more and protect this property? And almost immediately rewarded with an outpouring of support. In the days after, he did make an appearance in town hall, I think stopped by the town administrator's office and the assessor's office, to start exploring, you know, is there an accurate assessment of the land value? I think starting to look at some of these other things that you're going to have to do as you acquire large chunks of land.
Now, I believe that you and I had kind of a conversation last week when we were discussing having you on to be a guest and kind of, you know, share details about this purchase by John Hornstra. Is there a chance or a thought that, you know, that maybe some local legislation needs to be enacted for protection of this property? Or do you think that that's not necessary?
Yeah, so that's something I've been looking into a little bit, you know, after I spoke to you. So after, you know, before the auction, we learned that this property would not be eligible for agricultural preservation restriction. I spoke to someone with the Wildlands Trust, and he recommended that I look into a conservation restriction that the town could put on the deed. and sort of own and enforce. And so similar communities around us, I think Easton may have done one, is purchasing a conservation restriction to be placed on someone's deed. And that would restrict this land to be used as a farm or as open space, or however we phrase it, but to sort of prevent large residential developments from coming up in the future. And, you know, it's sort of paying now for the loss of resale value of the land, because if it can only be, if we are restricting the future uses of it, the current owner is taking sort of that loss in equity. But it's something that would be eligible for community preservation funds, and where it seemed like the Board of Selectmen and the Community Preservation Committee were already at least willing to consider exercising the right of first refusal to purchase the entire land outright, this would be less expensive, keep it as a farm, keep it as a working farm, potentially, and could be a long-term solution to not have to go through a land auction of the last big farm in Whitman again.
Again, if folks are just tuning in, we are speaking with Justin Evans. He is a member of the Whitman Board of Selectmen, the Select Board, and we're talking about the sale of the Peaceful Meadow property in Whitman on Route 18 with John Hornstra, as it's been reported in the news, that he purchased this. And again, he has he's established in Norwell. It'll be interesting to see how he'll operate between the two. Anything we haven't touched upon in regards to this property and this? I mean, this is a feel good story, and you know, a part of me, if I ever have a chance to come across John, would be like, did you have a chance days leading up to the auction? You know, to you know, purchasing it, did you see people kind of cheering on? Because I was seeing it on a lot of different groups. People saying, you know, and it wasn't just Whitman groups. There were a lot of surrounding communities, and there. You know, community Facebook pages and social media platforms saying that they were hoping a local farm like Hornstra's would be, you know, in the bidding to possibly purchase it and preserve that space. And again, maintain it as a family ice cream stand.
Yeah, the outpouring of support leading up to the auction and then the thanks afterwards extended. I think I was quoted on an Abington news page. I mean, this has been not just Whitman. Right. You know, East Bridgewater Facebook groups are lighting up about it. But, you know, the Patriot Ledger reported on it, which covers a lot more South Shore communities than just Whitman. You know, WBZ Radio was at the auction recording it. So, yeah, this was not just a local thing. This is really all of the South Shore. It's such a central spot. And I think the Plymouth store has since closed as well. So this was it. This is the last Peaceful Meadows location.
Any idea as to, I mean, have you been given any indication as to, you know, how long it may take for John Hornstra to kind of turn this around? Has anybody had a chance to talk with him and kind of get an idea of what his hope is to, you know, he's purchased this property and he's doing a little research right now, but, you know, again, you spend that money, you want to kind of recoup that money by, you know, having that ice cream stand eventually be reopened. And if you're going to be somebody who's going to be, you know, selling dairy products, you know, you got to, you know, spend the money to fix it up. How long will that take?
I know his intent right now is to get the dairy store up and running in time for eggnog season. So I guess before Thanksgiving.
Nice.
That would really be that's his first priority. I don't just guessing. I don't think we'll see the ice cream stand open before, you know, next summer's ice cream season. just to get everything up and running. You know, Peaceful Meadows used to be open year round. I think to do the maintenance and get everything up to speed there, it's probably going to take him a little bit more time. But I do think, you know, I've seen a couple of Whitman residents that have since signed up for his milk delivery service. So I think just that goodwill is already starting to be paid back, even if it's just a little bit.
If you were to kind of look at this, I mean, this is such a great feel-good story where, again, it could have turned into, you know, the property gets sold off. And, yeah, I know there's a desperate and dire need for housing stock in the Commonwealth. But I still feel this is kind of a win-win for the community of Whitman.
Yeah, this is really, I mean, it's a cultural win. It's such an important centerpiece for the town. I think we really got lucky. There was no guarantee that a farmer was going to step up and spend nearly $2 million with the fee on top,
right,
to purchase this farm. So So it's kind of why I want to look at the conservation restrictions and not hope that we get lucky a second time if it ever happens again.
Anything you want to say in closing in regards to this great feel-good story?
No, I just want to extend my thanks to John Hornstra and wish him well. Look forward to getting some ice cream in the future.
Same here. Hopefully, I would hope that John is someone who likes tuning into 95.9 WATD, and hopefully he hears from your lips to his ears. Hopefully he hears that and probably has collectively heard a sigh of relief from many of the folks on the South Shore who were hoping for the best outcome for that property. Justin, I want to thank you so much for your time and for continuing this conversation in regards to this family property.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. I'm glad to be the Peaceful Meadows correspondent for your station.
Well, you can be so much more. It's okay. I'm sure we're going to have you back on for many other things that is community related, especially when it comes to the town of Whitman.
All right. Thanks, Kevin.
You got it. All right. We're going to step aside. And when we come back, we are going to speak with Jody Jones, a senior program director with the Massachusetts Broadband Institute. Again, you're tuned into Monday Night Talk. 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
If you want a drink, that's your business. If you want to stop, that's for Alcoholics Anonymous.
AA is an inclusive fellowship of individuals all around the world. The one thing you need to ask yourself is, am I ready to do something about my drinking problem? For more information, literature, and videos about Alcoholics Anonymous, go to AA.org. To find a meeting near you, call 617-426-9444 or visit aaboston.org.
Are you ready to run and party? Hi, I'm Richard Rosen, owner of McGuigan's Pub and the patio at McGuigan's in Whitman. The annual McGuigan's Pub 5K is coming up on Sunday, September 24th. This certified 5K course starts at noon at McGuigan's Pub on Washington Street in downtown Whitman. T-shirts will be given to the first 300 runners who sign up, and awards will be given for the top winners in 8 age divisions. Stay after the run for an outdoor post-race block party at McGuigan's. Come to run, stay to party. All proceeds will benefit local charities. To register online, go to McGuigan'sPub.com.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And we return for more Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD, your Labor Day edition. Are you enjoying the mere few hours that are left of Labor Day? Well, I hope you had a great weekend. Our conversation, it continues. Right now, we are going to be speaking about a statewide listening series. This is a statewide series of listening sessions. This is something being put on by the Massachusetts Broadband Institute, joining us to kind of give us the details, because this is starting this week. We have Jody Jones. She is the Senior Program Director for the MBI, Massachusetts Broadband Institute. Jody, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. I'm very happy to be here.
So let's start out with, we don't know anything about the Massachusetts Broadband Institute. Tell us a little bit about MBI and the mission of the organization.
Sure. Yeah, so Massachusetts Broadband Institute, which is also referred to as MBI, is the official state broadband office of Massachusetts. So we are a division of Massachusetts Technology Collaborative, which is a tech and innovation economic development organization within the state. So we're one of 5 divisions of Mass Tech, and we're responsible for ensuring that every resident has access to the internet.
Okay. So tell us what sorts of projects has the MBI worked on in the past, maybe something that folks might recognize.
Sure. Yeah. So MBI was established in 2008 by state legislation, and the initial charter was really around developing the infrastructure that's necessary to deliver high-speed internet access. So the two flagship projects that Mass Broadband started with, if you think about it like Mass Broadband 1.0, was that we built a middle mile network, which is an industry term for a backbone of the internet, called the Mass 123 network. And then we also had a program called the Last Mile Program, which connected 53 towns out in western and central Massachusetts that were not connected to the internet. So between those two projects, the Middle Mile Network and also the Last Mile Program, we effectively connected parts of the state that had never had reliable access to the internet prior. So those were that was the initial mission of Mass Broadband Institute. Now today, future forward, MBI 2.0, we're really thinking about what's next for the state of Massachusetts. And that involves not just having the infrastructure, but also having what is referred to as digital equity, meaning that every resident has access to reliable, affordable internet and the tools that make using the internet possible.
Okay, very good. Well, and it's interesting, I believe that not too long ago that there was something that changed net neutrality and as to how the internet, you know, is divided up. And again, it's a conversation for another day. Now, as I teased at the start of our conversation, that there's going to be the MBI is going to be hosting a public forum called a regional listening session. I guess this is to solicit input from the community members about internet access. Would you be kind enough to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. And it's actually regional listening sessions because we're starting this week on Thursday, which we're excited. We'll be in Brockton. Yep. And we can't wait to see the Brockton and Southeast communities. But this will be one of many listening sessions around the state. So we're doing a whole roadshow out there to talk to folks and hear from them. Massachusetts has a goal of achieving Internet for All. And that's what the program that we're working on is called. It's literally called Internet for All, meaning that 100% of residents in the state will have access to high-speed internet. So this year, we're in a planning phase of the Internet for All project, which means that we are out talking to folks and want to hear from all voices to help us inform some strategic plans that we're putting together that will help us decide how we're going to spend some pretty significant federal funds that are coming into our state in the next few years.
So it's worth letting folks know, we're speaking with Jody Jones. She is the Senior Program Director for the Massachusetts Broadband Institute, talking a little bit about the first regional Southeastern listening session. This is going to be at the Boys and Girls Club of Metro South in Brockton this coming Thursday from 5 to 7 p.m. I believe that if folks can't attend, is there a virtual option?
Yep, there'll be a virtual option. People can attend on a Zoom webinar, or they can also, we have two satellite locations in the Southeast region, one in Plymouth and one in Dartmouth, that folks can go to their local library and participate that way as well. So we have many, many ways to participate. There's also a public survey that's out and available on a website that we've developed, MassBroadband.Massachusetts. I'm sorry, I'm going to say it wrong. It's the Internet for All site on the Mass Broadband website, and people can go there and take a public survey and give us input that way as well.
And if folks are just tuning in, talk to us. What is the goal? Is there a list of goals or a distinct goal for this listening session?
Yes, there is. So there's a federal investment coming to the state, which is a very meaningful $147 million that will be coming to Massachusetts for this broadband equity program. And so we want to hear from folks about what is important to them and what the needs of their community are. We want to understand if people have good, reliable access at their home, at their business, in their schools, because we're going to be putting together a plan to make sure that 100% of the state has access to the internet, and we need to know where the gaps are. So these listening sessions are community's opportunity to come to MBI, let us know where the needs are and what's important to them. So as we develop these plans and decide how we're going to be investing this generational investment that's coming to the state, we can have the voices of the people represented in that plan.
Let's talk about, let's say folks, they don't live in the Brockton area. Are there other listening sessions somewhere in our listening area?
Yes. Yeah, we have. So far we have seven listening sessions planned. This is in addition to an online survey that folks can take and focus groups that we're doing. But we'll be visiting the Cape. We're going to be in Hyannis. We'll be out up in the Northeast region in Lowell. We're going to be out in the western part of the state in Holyoke and Pittsfield. So we have many opportunities to talk to folks no matter what community they live in. And they can also visit us on the site that we've developed, broadband.masstech.org/internetforall, which is a great resource of all of this planning activity and has many ways that people can get involved in this process.
So how does your particular session relate to strategies that the state and federal government have around expanding internet access?
Yeah, so the federal government has mandated that states that receive money as part of these plans have to go through an extensive planning process that directly involves stakeholder engagement at the community level. So what we hear at these listening sessions, the input that we get from the public survey that we have out there, is going to be directly feeding the state's digital equity and broadband plan and the future of connectivity in Massachusetts. So this is it's a moment for broadband for Massachusetts. Like, this is a really important comparable to the 1930s and 40s when electrification was happening. Like, this investment is really important and meaningful, and we want to be good stewards of these dollars and make sure that, one, it goes as far as it can, and two, we understand where the gaps and needs are around the state so that we can address those needs. I also want to mention, Kevin, that Massachusetts is very well positioned. So as a state, the data that we have shows that over 98% of residents have access to the internet, but we know that's not telling the whole story. We know there are people out there who can't afford their internet bill. We know there are folks out there who don't have the resources or the knowledge of how to use the internet. So there's still a big digital divide that exists that we need to make sure that this funding addresses.
So depending on what your data says, it's possible to help that 2% of the population who does not have internet access. You also will be looking at where there is a low broadband access as well. Do you feel that does MBI feel that the $147 million is going to do the job to bring it up to speed, or is that necessarily what this whole listening session is about?
So that's part of the planning process as well. It's listening to stakeholders, understanding where the needs are, and then there's a lot of analysis that we're doing as part of the planning process to understand how that $147 million is going to be deployed. So that's part of the planning process too. And it remains to be seen what will, you know, if that's going to be enough or how we're going to invest that money. But we will be doing that analysis as part of the planning process as well.
Now, are you wanting folks to sign up to be a part of the listening sessions, whether it's in Brockton or the other seven spots around the Commonwealth?
Yes, we have a broadband.masstech.org/internetforall website that we've set up that is a public-facing, one-stop resource about all of the listening sessions and engaging in the Internet for All activities. So folks can go to that website, that Internet for All site. They can sign up for listening sessions. They can learn more about programming. This is going to be an ongoing, for the next 6 months, we'll be involved in a lot of planning processes, a lot of public engagement. So we want folks to pay attention to this and stay involved. And this will not be the only moment that people have to engage with us on this, because this is a big deal and we want to make sure that we keep lines of communication open with the communities.
So we've talked about the in-person component. We've talked about the option to join this virtually. What if somebody can't do either, but they want to submit their feedback to MBI?
If on the Internet for All site that I mentioned, there's a digital equity survey, a link there that folks can go on and take. It's a less than 5-minute survey, but that's a great way for people to participate in this process. There's questions about access. There's questions about devices. There's questions about affordability. So if people aren't able to attend a listening session or aren't able to participate virtually, please go on the Internet for All site and take that survey, and we'd love to hear from you that way as well.
Now, I know we've talked about this listening session, but maybe we can also look a little further into some of the things that MBI does, and that maybe there are projects that are being spearheaded by your organization that are going to help in the future. You want to share some of those details?
Yeah, definitely. So we have MBI, and after its 1.0 mission for the last mile towns and middle miles were completed, there's new programming that's being stood up. One is a digital equity partnership program, which is building capacity around the state of Massachusetts as it relates to digital equity. And we're working with community-based organizations who are standing up programs all over the state to help with device distribution, to help with skill development, to help with workforce development. So we are investing in those programs and in that capacity around the state. We also have a program called the Digital Equity Municipal Planning Program, which is partnering directly with municipalities to help them build their digital equity planning capabilities. So right now there's over 65 municipalities that have applied for this program, and we're working directly with folks who live and work in that in the municipalities to help them create their very own local digital equity plans that will help to, again, to identify needs and set goals, future goals for how their town and their community can work together and ensure that their businesses and residents are connected.
We know that there's well over 350 municipalities in and around the Commonwealth. How many municipalities would be eligible to be able to tap into this assistance?
Yeah. So we would love to have all municipalities eventually have a digital equity plan because we think it's that important. But we're very confident that we have a good amount of funding to get municipalities started on this. So, we're excited to invite and welcome more applications for that program.
Again, our guest for this conversation, Jody Jones, Senior Program Director for the Massachusetts Broadband Institute, talking about the MBI launching their statewide series of listening sessions on internet availability and digital equity. Jody, anything that we haven't talked about, any stones we did not turn over while we were chatting on this Labor Day?
I guess I'd just like to mention, I come from a healthcare background. I've most recently worked at Mass General with patients who have chronic kidney disease and heart disease. I saw the challenges that those who are living with chronic conditions face as they tried to access their chart and communicate with their care teams. And so I come at this work and see an opportunity that really involves public health. And I think that the health of the community where I live in Massachusetts, I wanted to be able to have an impact. And I feel like this work as an economic development tool is a real public health opportunity for the state to make sure that people are connected and have access to the best jobs, a skilled workforce, their schools, their healthcare. So I think this work is incredibly important to the future of Massachusetts and its residents.
Well, I want to thank you and also tip of the cap to Jake Stern for helping to get this conversation out there for folks who may be interested in sharing their thoughts and details when it comes to making sure that everybody has it's equitable when it comes to the internet. And I wish you, I hope you, your rest of your evening is great. And I'm sure maybe we can talk down the road somewhere about more things that MBI is doing.
Yes, great. And we hope to see folks in Brockton this Thursday.
You got it. Well, that does it for the first hour of Monday Night Talk. Time flies when you're having fun. But more conversation coming up in just a moment. Daniel Dane is going to talk to us about his new book coming out later this month, History of Boston. Again, you're tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD, also on 1460 AM WBMS. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We're back for the second hour of Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. And don't forget, later this hour, we will be speaking with Jerry Thornton from Barstool Sports. Jerry will be joining us to give us a little bit of a season preview, not only for the NFL, but for your New England Patriots. So stay tuned for that. But right now, we are privileged to be speaking with a gentleman who is going to be, his book's going to be published this month, September 19th. The book is called A History of Boston, and this is by our guest, Daniel Dane. He has contemporary photographs by Peter Vanderwalker. Dan, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Dan, first and foremost, tell folks a little bit about yourself. You are somebody who born in Boston, lives in Newton, but you're somebody who there's a lot that you do, especially as an attorney.
Yeah, I was born in Boston, lived in Brighton as a baby, grew up in Newton, went to Newton North. I live in Needham now with my family, but I work downtown. And I have a commercial real estate development law firm. I work with developers on doing projects in Boston and the area. And, you know, in advocating for my clients, I need to sort of make a case why a new development is good for the city. And that got me interested in principles of urbanism and led me to sort of what is the history of Boston, history of development in the city. And that got me working on this book project.
Now, is this the first time that you have written a book? Was this your first book or have you had other attempts at it?
Well, I was a longtime editor of a book on deposition practice, but that's a pretty narrow focus. And this is my first published book, that for a general audience. But I do consider myself a professional writer. I'm in the commercial real estate field in law, but I'm a litigator. And so my job day-to-day is in advocating for clients is to take a diverse set of facts, a stack of documents, interview notes, deposition transcripts, and try to put them together and tell a compelling story, a narrative. And so moving into the book field, I thought that the discipline of the exercise is really no different from what I do every single day as an advocate, which is, tell compelling stories. And so the book is really made up in a lot of ways. It's an 800-page book, but it was probably 1,000 different little stories from the history of Boston that are interesting.
Yeah, I mean, what made you choose to do a history on Boston and kind of, what made you think about doing such an undertaking? And if you will, also follow that up with, you had to do an enormous amount of research to be able to kind of put a book like this together.
I did. I didn't actually start off thinking I was going to write a history of Boston that would get published. There were a number of things bouncing around in my head going back to 2017. Both just to be a better advocate for my clients. I wanted to understand the history better. And in particular, the question that I was really focused on was, we've been in this period that I call high urbanism, which is a period when people want to live, work, play, study, visit, shop in cities, and in Boston in particular. And when my clients make a decision to buy a new building, build a new building, when my law firm makes a decision to hire new attorneys or staff, when companies make decisions to locate here, it's sort of based on an assumption that this period of people wanting to be in the cities is going to continue. But, having grown up in the 70s in Boston, I knew that we can't take that for granted, that from really the 1920s into the 1990s, Boston was a basket case. In the late 1950s, Moody's declared Boston's bond level to be just above the junk level. In the early 1980s, as late as the 1980s, the Brookings Institute declared Boston the most blighted big city in the entire country. In 1950, the population of Boston was 800,000 people. 30 years later, the 1980 census, Boston lost nearly 300,000 people and moved out of Boston in just 30 years. And so I knew that we couldn't take Boston for granted or that people, if you build a new building, that there would be people to live in it or companies to lease space or hotel rooms to fill up. And so I really was curious why that was, why Boston was doing so well recently, why it had done so poorly before. And if you go back to the 19th century, Boston was so successful as a city, really the launching point for the Industrial Revolution in America, the abolition movement, the women's rights movement. You had all these things going on in Boston. It was such a successful city in the 19th century that, the old Shawmut Peninsula ran out of room and we needed to fill in the South Cove, the South End, the waterfront, Back Bay, parts of what are today South Boston. East Boston at the time was a series of small islands. That's all landfill. So we spent the 19th century filling in all this space to accommodate all the people. So I was really interested in this question of why do cities go back and forth between periods of success and failure? And the other thing that was going on in my head in 2017 when I started the project was just when I have visitors come from out of town or even walking around the city with friends, I love to tell stories of Boston. I've always been interested in Boston history. And I would sort of, I love being a Boston tour guide, but in the back of my head, I always had this, like, am I getting these stories right? You know, I would take people to the North End and I'd tell the story of Paul Revere and the Old North Church. And I'd say, wait, is it, you know, is it one lantern or two? Was Paul Revere the one who received the signal or was he the one who gave the signal? Was Paul Revere in the North End or was he in Charlestown? The answer, by the way, is that it was two lanterns. Paul Revere was the signal giver. Paul Revere was in the North End before he was arrived. But, so I had all these things bouncing around in my head, and one day I literally went around my house and pulled off my shelf every book I had related to Boston history, maybe 20 or 30 books. I just started taking notes on them and then typed them up in an outline, and I just thought, well, I have an outline. If I have a guest come from out of town, I'll pull the outline out, you know, the day before they come and refresh my memory on some of these details. But as I wrote more of the outline, more questions popped up, you know, and I just, as a lawyer, what I really do is I ask questions and try to find answers to them. And so as I ask more questions, I need to get more books and do more research, which all led to more questions. And the outline started turning into complete sentences and complete paragraphs. And it sort of took on a mosaic or a puzzle-like quality in that I wasn't writing it chronologically. I mean, it was, the history was written chronologically, but my writing was, you know, all over the place depending on what questions I was asking and what research I was doing. So I would just in bold write questions or have placeholders saying, you know, more research here. And after a year or two, after it became like 100 pages, I said, thought to myself, well, I guess I'm into this now. And I kept writing until I felt like I'd covered all the different topics and filled in all the gaps. And while the book is 800 pages, it covers, I start with the geologic formation of the Boston Basin area, which I think is important to understand that geologic history, because, for instance, you know, the drumlins around Boston were glacial moraine, you know, glacial deposits. They were made of gravel, and that's important because when we did the landfill, we could dig out the hills, the gravel, to do the landfill. If the hills had been made out of bedrock, you wouldn't have been able to do that. The fact that, you know, Boston is on the ocean, it has rivers, these all contributed to the history of Boston. So I start 580 million years ago with the first geologic formation, volcanic activity. Go all the way up to November of 2021 with the election of Michelle Wu, because I was, you know, as I was writing starting in 2017 and going up to the present, the present kept moving. So finally in 2021, I said I just needed endpoints to stop my research, and stopped in November 2021. But that's a lot of history to cover. Boston, you know, I make the argument that Boston has the most important history of any city in the country, and it has lessons that are important for the country and the world in terms of understanding cities.
Some of the information that I was able to get for this interview was that, I guess the count is 265 books, nearly 500 articles and research papers, and that you actually visited more than 70 historical sites. Did you enjoy this?
Oh, it was awesome. I mean, I have a full-time job, and I'm on 7 different boards, and I have 2 kids in high school, although they weren't in high school when I started the project. But, you know, my son is a very competitive soccer player, so we do a lot of traveling. So I have a lot of other commitments, so I had to find the time around it all. But I loved every minute of the research and writing. And, you know, I have sections on, for instance, I have a history of Boston restaurants. So, you know, if I'm going to write about the restaurants, I need to try them. So I, you know, like, family got dragged around to a lot of restaurants. That was kind of the upside. But it also meant that if I wrote about a historic house, you know, I wanted to go visit the house. So, you know, we all got dragged around to a lot of acting as a tourist. And I really wrote the book kind of as a tour, in the voice of a tour guide. If I mention a historic place, I'll say, you know, this is open to the public, this is run by, you know, the National Park Service, or, you know, whatever organization happens to run a particular building, you know, and act as a tour guide and mention the places that people should go around the region. And while it's per se a history of Boston, it's really a history of New England, in that, you know, if you talk about trying to understand the history of Boston, you know, the Pilgrims arrived, in, you know, in Plymouth, not in Boston, in 1620. The Puritans didn't come until 10 years later, you know, founded Boston in 1630. The Battle of Cockair in Lexington obviously happened outside of Boston. So, you know, you can't really tell the history of Boston without understanding the history of all of New England. And so Boston is really the economic capital. Whaling was essential to understand the economy of New England in the 19th century. So I tell the history of whaling, which really was run out of New Bedford and Nantucket, but the capital came from Boston. And so, you know, you had to understand that. I read these books that I loved, and I try to promote the books, and I made it a discipline that every book that I cite, I read from cover to cover, because, you know, I wanted to know the history. You know, I was learning a little, you know, through this process, and you know, hope that that enthusiasm comes through on the pages.
Again, if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Daniel Dane. He is the author of A History of Boston. Again, this is going to be out in stores, shelves, and available online. Published date is September 19th. We'll get more details in a few moments. Knowing that you're taking all this information in, and I'm sure you probably had some depth to your knowledge of Boston, were there a few things about Boston's history that caught you by surprise?
A lot more than a few things. I thought I was a very knowledgeable Bostonian, and you know, I felt that I was such a knowledgeable Bostonian that I would act as a tour guide to visitors or even people from around here when we travel around. But what was so exciting to me is to learn all these stories that I had no idea about. I think the one that surprised me the most was that Boston was the location of the first American civil rights movement in the 1840s. Now, Boston is known as the home of the abolition movement, which was most active in the 1850s after the fugitive slave law in 1851. But a decade earlier in the 1840s, the free black community of Boston rebelled against what were essentially Jim Crow laws in the North. Boston, slavery ended in Massachusetts. Massachusetts was the first state to stop having slaves. There was never a statute passed, but through court decisions, slavery ended in 1783. But in the northern states, slavery was legal through the Revolutionary War in every one of the colonies. But in the late 1700s, the northern states all ended slavery, but they replaced slavery with effectively Jim Crow, what we called Jim Crow laws in the 20th century, which were, you know, these laws enforcing segregation. And Boston, as well as all the other northern cities, were segregated cities in the first half of the 19th century. So theaters, churches, of course, schools, railroad cars, places of employment were all segregated. Most places of employment were not open to the African-American community in Boston. And the African-American community starting in the 1840s, used all the tools that we think of with the American Civil Rights Movement in the 1950s and 1960s to force change. So there was leafleting and picketing and acts of civil disobedience. African-Americans would go into segregated theaters and, you know, buy tickets and sit down in white sections and get arrested as acts of civil disobedience. And they managed to desegregate the city, you know, as a legal matter. You know, obviously, as we know from the school busing case in the 1970s, there were still, you know, there were other means to enforce segregation in the city, unfortunately, in the 20th century. But this remarkable civil rights movement became a template for the American civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s. And I was surprised to see how much of, if you go back and read Thurgood Marshall's brief and before the Supreme Court and Brown v. Board of Education, he references Boston in the case, you know, the legal cases from Boston in the 1840s. That was a remarkable story that I had no idea about.
Well, let's talk about how you came to team up with photographer Peter Vanderwalker. This is a gentleman who I believe that you see as probably one of the best urban photographers around. How did they come to the two of you teaming up?
So I had finished a manuscript in 2022. As I mentioned, I called November 2021, the end of my, you know, my end point for the story. So in 2022, I was just finishing up and putting the finishing touches on the manuscript and looking to get published, and I was introduced to Peter. And I didn't know him personally, but I had a bunch of his books because he really is the best urban photographer in Boston, and he has a national audience. And I really encourage people to go find his books, his photography books on urban places, on buildings. He's got a great one sort of Boston Here and Now, where he takes historic photos, compares them to contemporary photos. So a friend introduced us, and we had dinner together, and I gave him my manuscript, just, you know, because I thought it was interesting to meet him. And apparently he doesn't really read books, but his wife tells me that he brought it home and sat down and started reading and didn't put it down until he was finished. And then he called me up and he said, I love your manuscript so much. I will give you access to my entire archives. You can pick out any contemporary photographs you want as long as you put my name on the cover. And I said, absolutely. that was a no-brainer. I couldn't believe my luck. And so I really think the book is enriched by Peter's contemporary photographs, which are incredible. The cover, I love the picture on the cover. The end pages have beautiful color photos, and then there are black and white photos throughout the book, as well as historic photos. There are over 200 photographs in the book. And I do think that when reading such a long book, particularly a history book, it's so important to have references to maps and historic images, as well as contemporary photos of some of these historic places. And then just some beautiful photos that I liked and just stuck in there for visual interest. So I think teaming up with Peter really, really helped, you know, us get a publisher for the book and hopefully find an audience for it. It's been available for pre-sale in some of the large, online booksellers, and, you know, it's doing very well, extremely well on pre-sales. And as you mentioned, September 19th, it'll be in bookstores, and September 18th, I'm going to be at the Cambridge Public Library to give a talk, and I have a bunch of other book talks and book signings. People, please look for those. I'd love to meet people and happy to sign copies. And, you know, I sort of like the book, and I think Boston is an important city, and I hope people read it and appreciate the city as well.
Interesting enough, during our conversation, you've detailed a couple of timelines, and during them, it seems as though that some of your work was obviously done during the pandemic. I've had a chance to speak with other authors, and some of them have said that, you know, the pandemic was a partial reason. Some felt that it was a bonus to be able to write during COVID. Others felt it kind of hindered them. How did this hurt or help? How did the pandemic hurt or help your process of putting this book together?
Well, I mean, you put your finger on it exactly in terms of how I was able to finish an 800-page book while having all these commitments. I was working steadily on it from late 2017, but mostly I work the full day, have different board meetings, you know, do soccer practice, driving. I always came home for dinner, have dinner, do stuff around the house, and then I would, once everyone was sort of up to bed at 10 or 11 o'clock at night, is when I would sit down and do my writing. And so I'd usually write from 10 or 11 until maybe 1 in the morning. And I was making good progress, and I had a couple hundred pages by early 2020, but I was really thinking, this is going to take me forever at the pace I'm going to cover everything. And then, you know, one day in the office, we said, okay, don't come in tomorrow. And not only did it eliminate my commuting time from Needham into Boston, but, you know, for at least through that summer of 2020, you know, board meetings stopped, soccer practice stopped. Eventually things picked back up through Zoom. Of course, that saved me commuting time. I also spent a lot of lunches and dinners doing client development and networking, and that all stopped. And suddenly I had not, you know, 2 hours at night, but maybe 5 or 6 hours each day of extra time. And so, yeah, I mean, I would say I wrote more than half of the book, you know, from March of 2020 into the fall of 2020. I mean, it was just so much more time. I really don't think I ever would have finished it if I didn't have that block of time.
Let's talk about your day job. Did it give you a unique perspective when you were writing this book?
Yeah, absolutely. And my day job animated, you know, the entire project. It's a general history of Boston. You know, as I mentioned, I cover the history of restaurants, history of music, right, theater, sports, you know, the economy, politics, geography. It's a general history, but as I mentioned before, what was animating it, it was trying to understand this, what makes cities successful or not successful. And that really was tied to my day job of being an advocate for real estate development in the city, which I just think is so important because building densely in cities is really the best land use response we have today to the crises that we face as a society today of really a housing crisis. Building densely in the city addresses that. Transportation crisis of moving people around the city and the region. You know, obviously the climate crisis, moving people to places where they can walk to work or shopping or take public transportation, gets people out of cars. And on a per capita basis, we know that people in cities consume carbon at a much lower rate than people more remotely from cities. And so, you know, my belief in what I call density, diversity, and good urban design really, you know, is a guiding principle throughout the book because I tell it as a critical history of the city. I tell a general history, but one where you hear my voice throughout, providing commentary on the different decisions that were made throughout the city's history and evaluating it based on the perspective of, you know, does it lead to good outcomes from the city? And the consistent theme is when the city has embraced density, diversity, and good urban design, the city's been successful. And when it rejected those principles in the 20th century by tearing down dense neighborhoods as part of urban renewal, building highways to move people out of the city, the way we finance public education, all these things, rejecting good principles of urbanism, the city failed. It was really an urban disaster for seven decades. And so that all comes out from my professional interests. And you know, I think the book helps me as an advocate for my clients. And so I sort of enjoy that dynamism of the book being both sort of just a general interest of mine as well as something that fits in with what I do professionally.
Again, if you are tuned in, we are speaking with Daniel Dane, author of A History of Boston. Again, be out in stores on September 19th. Dan, anything that I haven't asked you while we have a moment or two left with you, I haven't asked you, but it feels very important to sharing with the listeners in regards to this book and why it should be something that they grab and read?
I mean, the people who have read it have really enjoyed it. And I think what makes the book successful is that as a litigator, as a trial attorney, my job is to tell interesting stories. And so, you know, I don't think this is a dry history. This is really a collection of really interesting stories that I've found, and I try to tell them in a compelling narrative. And it's not a book, I hope people aren't intimidated by the length of the book. It's not a book where you have to sit down and read it from one end to the other, because if you put it down, you'll forget where you left off. It really is a series of stories, and so you don't need to read it in chronological order. You can bounce around. If you're interested in revolutionary history, just go to the chapter on you know, Boston's role in the Revolutionary War. Or if you're interested in the Industrial Revolution, go to that section, or the abolition movement, or, you know, James Michael Curley's administration. Go to the different sections and read the stories from the different parts of Boston history. And, you know, I think people will find it interesting.
Will this also be available as a digital download or even something that you would do for audiobooks?
It is available as a digital book, so people can certainly read it that way. An audiobook, I have to find someone to read it, and so I'm waiting on that because I don't think I have the voice to read it.
I don't know. I disagree. You got a great voice. I like it. I don't know.
I appreciate it.
Do you know who Natalie Jacobson is?
Of course.
Okay. So I actually had her on the show a year ago, and I actually not only read her book, but I listened. She actually voiced her own book, and it was amazing hearing her as she articulated her book. I feel as though when the author does it, it adds something to it. That's just my two cents.
I would love to do that. I would just need to find a big period of time where I could read it.
You can do it, right? Well, Dan, I want to thank you so much for joining us. If folks want to find out more information about the book, or if they want to, do you have a website? Do you have social media platforms that the folks can reach out and find out more about you and the book?
So my law firm is called Dane Torpy, DaineTorpy. And there are links to where you can buy the book on pre-sale on our firm website, as well as we're on LinkedIn and I guess what used to be Twitter is now X. And we have a marketing person who's been promoting the book and is mentioning where there are book readings and signings. So you can get information on that. But I also encourage people to buy it from their local bookstores, because I even have a little section on the history of independent bookstores in Boston, because they're so important to building community. So I hope people will go in and support their local businesses.
Well, I want to, again, thank you for taking time to join us and share details on this book and all that went into it. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure that the listeners do as well.
My absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
You got it. We are going to step aside just for a couple of moments, but we have one more segment left. That's right. Jerry Thornton from Barstool Sports joining us in just a moment. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Fall is a great time to enjoy alfresco dining at the patio at McGuigan's. Start your open-air meal with a patio sampler platter piled high with chicken wings, cauliflower, potato skins, egg rolls, and chicken and biscuits. The patio's specialties include Koji steak tips, braised short ribs, pan-seared salmon, and chicken marsala. Looking for something lighter? Sink your teeth into a patio burger, pulled pork sandwich, fish tacos, or margarita flatbread. Friday and Saturday nights feature live entertainment at the patio at McGuigan's. Sip on a specialty cocktail and unwind from the week as the fall breeze cools down the evening. The patio at McGuigan's is at 552 Washington Street in Whitman Center. And check out McGuigan's Pub next door at 546 Washington Street, also in Whitman Center.
Head. Indulge yourself every Wednesday night. Tune into the Francesca Luca Show and join me for provocative conversation, intriguing stories, and inspiration. So sit back and relax, or be stimulated, or both. Because being connected feels good. And who doesn't need more of that these days? Don't miss the Francesca Luca Show Wednesdays at 9 p.m. on 95.9 WATD.
Be a part of the show. Call and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk.
The final segment of your Labor Day is here. And who else would I bring on to give you a little bit of a give you kind of a little pre-gaming when it comes to the New England Patriots? We know that the NFL will be kicking off later on this week. Your New England Patriots, if you still call them your New England Patriots, will be taking to the field. Tom Brady, I think, will be in town. I think he's having a big day for him. Maybe the Patriots pull out a win. But none other, probably one of my all-time favorite guests, Mr. Jerry Thornton, who I've known for many years, and he's been kind enough to be in studio, call in, give his thoughts on sports, life in general. Things are great over at your place of business these days, huh?
Sports, life in general, Barstool, metaphysics, mathematics, whatever you want to talk about, pseudosciences, I don't care. Kevin, happy Labor Day to you and to all the hardworking people in your listening audience. I respect people who do hard work. Not enough to have ever done a decent day's work in my entire life, but I respect people who do it, and I'm glad that you guys have a holiday that I can sort of kick back on as well.
Here, here. So, 20th anniversary.
Yeah.
Barstool Sports. Yeah. You guys had a big red carpet type of thing. I hear that Dave Portnoy has bought back Barstool and is back in charge. How is things at the place of business, Barstool Sports?
If I can go back a little bit, about 19, and a half years ago, maybe 19 and three quarters years ago, I found an ad on a site. I was looking up just a article, whatever, and this thing comes up saying there's a site that's it wasn't a site. It was a newspaper, a physical print newspaper. Kids, ask your grandparents what a newspaper was. And it was, I reached out to this guy, said he was looking for writers. I send an email. I get an email back saying send a writing sample. I did. And I got an immediate response that said, okay, you're in. It doesn't pay anything. And it was Barstool Sports. So I was like, whatever, twice a month I write a 1,000-word article. I finally got my hands on a copy. I read the other writers, and I'm like, holy cats, these guys are good. Wow, are they talented. I really have to up my game. These articles are funny and in-depth, whatever. And then I met these guys, and to a some extent, they said they felt the same way about mine. There were just four of us. And we did this for a couple of years, and then we turned into a daily blog and just incrementally took off. And for it to have gone – like I stuck with it even though I wasn't getting paid, even though I was doing it at my old day job. I was getting in trouble or whatever. I stuck with it because I said maybe this will turn into something. I don't know what. Maybe I'll be able to like get a job in another media or something. Maybe this will start putting some grocery money in my pocket. And it went to the moon and beyond, to the point where here it is 20 years later and I'm walking a red carpet and there's people with taking photos and shouting out names or whatever. We fill the house of blues and there's awards. And it was just, Kevin, it has been the craziest ride ever. Now, to your question about how I feel about it now that Dave's back in. So we got bought out by a corporation and then by Penn Gaming, who were terrific to me insofar as no one ever said a word to me. And they just let me do my thing, whatever.
Sign the checks.
Yes, exactly. And which I always take people's silence as a tacit endorsement for all my misbehaviors. So I feel like I can get away with any. No, they were great. But now that Dave bought it back from them for $1, it's great. Because, again, for that history that we hung out together, we bowled together in a bowling league, and we, you know, busted each other's chops. But he was always been great to me. The loyalty is rare in this world. Speaking of Labor Day, I just wish everybody out there sincerely could work for somebody who appreciates them and that they can appreciate the way I've found myself in this situation through some sort of serendipitous miracle. So, yeah, it's great that he's back in charge and we can kind of go back a little bit more to our pirate ship roots. And that's really what it's all about.
I will have to tell you that in recent months, now, you've always been my all-time favorite at Barstool Sports, bar none. You still sit at the top. You're like, you know, any recording artist who's been on the Billboard charts, you know, number one for oh so many weeks, you're like that. But
I sense a butt coming. There's the butt. Okay.
Somebody who
I was ready to just like cut off the mic in mid-sentence. But yes, I'm sorry.
Somebody who cemented themselves right behind you is Dave Portnoy. Not because of his antics, but I will tell you, not because of his antics that you may see online, but I'm a big fan of his pizza reviews. And when he goes into a place and when he does these little snippets, he's got somebody who's on the cell phone taping it. It's just his whole spiel when he goes in and he rates the pizzas. One bite, everybody knows the rules. And, you know, oh, it's a great undercarriage. And it, just to hear him kind of just talk about it, he even went to Italy and was trying pizza there. And I mean, the guy's like a globetrotter trying pizza and different foods. I've become every time there's a new one, I got to at least spend the 60 to 70 seconds that it has taken for him to tape to share it to the world.
And you are not alone. Like, do you know the origin of those? It just began a conversation around the office about if you could have just one food the rest of your life, what would it be? Someone saying tacos. Someone said burgers or sandwiches or whatever. And he said pizza. And that was the origin of this thing, which has taken off to the point where, I mean, when some place gets a positive review, it gets swamped. Someone told me, you know, about a chain place down the Cape that he gave a 5-star review to, and the next day there was a line around the block. There is no disputing the power of the pizza review, how just iconic it is and what a brand it is. And I think there's people who don't read a word of Barstool, but know that those exist. And go figure how you're never going to really understand what can go viral and take off in this world. I never would have predicted it, but Kevin Tocci's a fan, a guy who knows his way around a pizza. You and I have split more than our share in this crazy ride we're having together.
Indeed, yeah. Well, we've had, we get a great sponsor like McGuigan's Pub, but I've also had Cape Cod Cafe Pizza here, and then folks on the South Shore would say that in Linwood and Town Spa are like right there. Although I do have a friend of mine who's been on the radio show as well, who was a little upset that Dave didn't give the Linwood as high a ranking as it should have received. You're not going to please everybody.
To each his own, right? I mean, there's movies like The Godfather that have 98% on Rotten Tomatoes. So who are those other two?
Who knows?
I don't know.
Who knows?
It happens. Our pal Kerry Byrne was at this very microphone years ago explaining to me that South Shore Bar Pizza exists only around here. And I thought he was referring to what I consider pizza because I grew up here, and that how the thing that comes in the metal pan and they serve it.
10-inch plates, pie plates.
They put it between the cardboard pie plates and put it in a bag, which to me was food growing up. It began in Dorchester, and it worked its way down Route 37 to the places you mentioned, to Linwood's, to Cape Cod Pizza, whatever. I'm like, that broke my brain. I'm like, wait, Route 37 is the Silk Road of pizza. Go figure. But there's one specific kind that outside of 128, people have no idea what you're talking about. What a world.
It's interesting that you also bring up Kerry, because a very popular Facebook group, South Shore Bar Pizza, I believe that Kerry is one of a handful of people who are helped create that, and has grown to 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 people who are on that site just complaining and fighting each other over who has the best pizza.
Is that incredible?
That's incredible.
You know your Facebook page has really made it, not by the numbers, but by how much vitriol there is, how much people just scream at each other.
Ban.
The passion with which my pal Greg Murphy, the comic, was in Italy, took a picture of a pizza he had, and someone said, "That looks like garbage. It looks like terrible." He's in Italy. You know what I mean? That's when you just know that you've really succeeded. When people treat other human beings like garbage.
He is Jerry Thornton, a great friend here to talk everything. Well, I was going to get into comedy, but I don't think we have time for that. I want to talk Patriots because I know you have probably a lot to say. I'm sure you've had a chance to be down at training camp. You've already been through the cutdown day and, oh my God, we only have one quarterback. Give me your thoughts. Here we are. We're heading into the regular season of the Patriots. How do you feel at this particular point when we talk about the New England Patriots and looking at their schedule?
Well, and to be clear, they waived their second and third string quarterbacks. They went through waivers. They re-signed them. Like, they did that calculation. Right, exactly. For 24 hours, I get it. It feels weird, and that's a big gamble to take. The gamble worked. The gamble paid off. He has the guys that he wanted and that he scouted, drafted, and then in the case of Malik Cunningham, signed to a undrafted free agent contract. So chill on the panic, everyone. There were only 24 waived players signed by other teams in the entire league, and everyone, 32 teams times like 40 guys were released all at the same time, what that amounts to, but it was a tiny fraction. So anyway, I'm going to tell you what I said last year, which is double-digit wins. At the end of the season, they're knocking on the door of a playoff berth. I'm sure they'll have to win games at the end in order to do it. Now, I said that last year, and I was off by how many? They went 8-9, meaning Ramondre Stevenson, a very sure-handed back, fumbles in the red zone against Cincinnati, a Final Four team in the NFL. Otherwise, that's a win. With no time left on the clock going into overtime, Jacoby Myers commits the single worst play in the history of the NFL, throwing it backwards 30 yards into Chandler Jones's arms. Give me those two plays, and they're 10-7, and they're knocking on the door of the playoffs. I think they've improved. The last year, all their problems can be traced to two things. terrible special teams, which they've improved on, and Matt Patricia and Joe Judge running the offense, two guys who hadn't the first clue, who didn't have the wherewithal to say, I don't have the first clue how to do this, who never figured it out. And I say this, the one guy in the world I wanted to have running this team last year, I now have running this offense, which is Bill O'Brien. A guy uniquely suited to do this because he's done it before at a very high level. He's been around to other spots. He's picked up a lot of things in the meantime, including Alabama, where Mac Jones played. Where Mac Jones, as he was leaving Alabama, Bill O'Brien was coming in. The two sat down, and Jones explained the schemes and the offense and the calls and the nomenclature and the audibles and all that stuff to him. So these guys are simpatico. And I posit you this, Kevin. The most important acquisition in the NFL this year is Bill O'Brien. And he's going to cure a lot of these ills.
What I find interesting is that I think the Mac Jones that we saw last year, I think, is going to be vastly different this year because he's had that time to get to have time with Bill O'Brien, have an NFL style offense instead of, you know, two coaches who are learning it on the fly themselves.
Right.
You know what I mean? And, you know, having the equivalent of the Brockton Boxers football team out there. All right, we're going to run student body left and student body right. And, you know, third down, we're going to do a bubble screen.
Right, right. I remember all the stuff about, you know, a lot of people turned on Mac Jones because it was body language and he was throwing a fit and he was yelling at Matt Patricia. If he was yelling at Matt Patricia, he was only yelling at him not as vociferously as every other person in New England. We were all screaming at our
at
TVs.
Home, yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Using more foul language than he did because of the frustration level. And the moment where he really melted down, and I think he tried to control it, he tried to deal, he tried to push through, when it finally just came to a boil, was they had a first and goal, big moment in a game, the play call comes in with 4 seconds left, and they got to burn a timeout. It's like not every high leverage play has to be like James Bond having to defuse a bomb before it goes off. Mm. 5, 4, 3, and then they had a false start penalty, and then the push back 5 yards. So he's frustrated. Join the club, Mac. I was frustrated long before you were, and Patricia, look, he was out of his depth, okay? Maybe you can't blame him. He's one of God's children, too. I'm sure he's a very nice man, very smart guy, but he couldn't figure this out. That's not going to be a problem this year, and Mac Jones's best strength is what every Patriots quarterback needs first and foremost, and it's what's between his ear holes. You know, it's being able to process information, make decisions, know what a defense is giving you. Having an accurate arm is really important, but this, you don't need one of those guys who, you know, they used to say about Jamarcus Russell, he can throw a ball 60 yards in the air from his knees. Yeah, not a useful skill. It's not a league where it's not dwarf on football, you know what I mean?
Right. And if you're on your knees throwing the ball, you're considered down, so.
Yeah, exactly. How's that for an obscure reference? Dwarf on golf.
Wow.
If you didn't get the newspaper reference, you're not going to remember Tim Conway VHSs. But, yeah, listen, they do have issues. I don't want to, put too fine a point on this. The offensive line, if they don't work out, if they can't, you know, get that settled down. And it hasn't been settled all through training camp because of injuries. But Cole Strange is coming back. Michael Onwenu, who's their best offensive lineman, he's coming back. They're on either side of David Andrews. There's the core that you can settle in. They need time together. They need continuity. Because if they don't, Kev, then I suggest to every male in your listening audience, tell your wife or your girlfriend, yeah, we're available to go apple picking on Sundays this fall. You want to put on some fleece and go up to a corn maze and maybe see some covered bridges? Okay, I can do that because Sunday's not going to be a day where you're going to need to sit there and watch football.
Yeah,
trust me.
It'll be like the Dick McPherson years.
Yes, but they have a new offensive line coach because Joe Judge was handling it last year.
Adrian Clem.
And it's Adrian Clem who has been around college and pro, coached at a high level, and trivia question, was the first draft pick that Bill Belichick made with the Patriots back in 2000. So they know one another. They have that rapport, but that's not what's important. What's important is that he can coach offensive line. Give him the five cards. He can discard a little bit. He can build a good poker hand with what he's got. But so far, he hasn't had anything. He's had to just like fold, and hopefully going forward doesn't have to.
Let me hear you as far as offensive weapons that the Patriots that are going to be at Mac Jones's disposal. You've got a name. You got a guy named Kayshon Booty, yep. Right?
Imagine. Yeah, and we're all going to have to come to a consensus, people, about how many booty jokes we're going to allow each other. Like, he scored a touchdown in preseason. I tweeted out booty call. I kind of think I bagged my limit there. Eh? Yeah. The poor guy's been listening to it his whole life. He had to have.
Right. But then you got DeMario Pop Douglas.
Douglas, yeah.
He's a good guy. You've got Mike Gesicki, who was, I thought he was great with the Dolphins. I think he's going to be a great compliment with Hunter Henry.
Hybrid wide receiver tight end.
And Ezekiel Elliott. I mean,
yeah.
That's an upgrade over Pierre Strong any day.
Yes, and I have nothing bad to say about Jacoby Myers, that throw to Chandler Jones notwithstanding, but he hit his ceiling. I mean, yes, he was the best. He was the favorite wide receiver of five starting quarterbacks we've had going back to Cam Newton. That's not by accident. But we saw his ceiling. He's a 700-and-something yard guy. They replaced him with Juju Smith-Schuster, whose peak was 1,400 yards back in 2018.
Right.
While, by the way, Antonio Brown was on that same team, he had more yards, more catches than him. He was more of a go-to guy. And what did he do last year? He had 933 yards for Kansas City. And what did they do?
You got a ring.
Oh, yeah, they won the Super Bowl.
You got a ring.
Now, again, 933 feels impossible if you look at the last 4 years on this Patriots offense, because they've not had that wide receiver one. I believe he is that guy, but they don't need more than they rarely have more than 1,000 yards out of a guy because they spread it around. It's
always
that old, who's our best favorite target? The one who's open,
right?
You know what I mean? So yeah, if all these guys are capable of being in that range of, you know, 400 yards on the low end and, you know, knocking on the door of 1,000 on the high end, including Hunter Henry, including Devontae Parker. It's a lot of yards right there. And, you know, it's about having a quarterback who is in the system where he can figure out best before the snap who gets the ball. And I'm very high on Booty and on DeMario Douglas. So for guys who are, you know, late-round flyers, to even make the roster and not be on the practice squad or whatever, that's impressive. And then one guy who's going to start the first month on IR, but they drafted in the second round last year, my namesake, Tyquan Thornton. By the way, he's injured for the second straight year, and you know why? Because I bought his jersey. I really debated whether I should buy it, because it's just, I'm a real Jonah when it comes to this stuff. I'm just that jinx that you just want to throw overboard the ship because I'm just going to be bad luck. So I'm sorry, Tyquan, but I love the number 11.
Is it too late to do a jersey burning? And maybe this will be like, you know.
It's not too late. But
reverse the curse?
I'm, you know, Irish, so I'm too cheap. Okay. You know what I mean? To possibly burn a $99 jersey.
So let's talk the other side of the ball. We know that, you know, if anything that hasn't been a problem for the Patriots is their defense. And, you know, I think they've gotten stronger. They drafted a cornerback. They got this kid, Keyshawn White, who seems as though he's going to be a beast.
Yeah, Keyshawn White.
Keyshawn.
He played a lot of preseason in the first game and then established himself enough that they gave him the ultimate compliment, which was not to play him much after that.
Right.
That's always a good sign. Rarely, you know, you might get there was that one year where Jason McCourty was playing deep into the fourth quarter of his fourth preseason game. I'm like, what is this, punishment duty? Is he not going to make the team? No, they were just getting him accustomed to everything because he was new in town. But White established himself. Christian Gonzalez, by all accounts, was a top 10 overall draft pick who, for reasons nobody can figure out, just the vagaries of the draft. It's not like there were red flags or whatever. He just dropped all the way to them at 17, which was a miracle. And then you get this guy, Marty Mapu, who's this super versatile kind of movable. Yeah, exactly.
Hybrid,
like a movable chess piece who can play safety and then play linebacker, and you can line up way outside covering a tight end or whatever. He's a bit of a cipher right now because he wore red, you know, non-contact jersey all throughout camp, but got some snaps in the final preseason game, quite a few, I think like 26 or something, and conducted himself well. Again, that ability to move all around the field, which, you know, they love versatile guys. Like, you know, Jalen Mills, another versatile guy who's played all over the
quarterback. He's going to eat one of your safeties.
Yep, all over the secondary. Mm. You know, would you say, and this is kind of a pivot, but I'm bringing it back to what we're talking about. Mm. In the championship era, who's the second best Patriots player of this era, in your humble opinion?
Second best. That's tough, because I can name a bunch. I mean, I think of a Rodney Harrison.
Sure.
I think of Teddy Bruschi. I think of there's a bunch.
A lot of people say Randy. I mean, maybe Randy Moss for a real short time, but Gronk. Gronk.
Rob Gronkowski. But he was you know, great in the, when it, running up the seam. He was a great player. Yeah. Offensively.
I say all things considered. On the field, off the field, durability, number of reps, playing special teams, leadership, that to me is Devin McCourty. So they lost him, and yeah, I was deeply concerned about that when they did. We were lucky to have him last year. But I think that they're uniquely situated to absorb that loss because of Mills, because I think that Kyle Duggar is establishing himself as a Pro Bowler. Adrian Phillips has been just a godsend. So
you got Matthew Slater still on the team.
Yep, exactly. Special. And then you add you know, Mapu and what he's going to be able to bring hopefully to the table. So yeah, I think secondary is a strength in spite of the fact that they lost, for my money, the second best player in this whole dynasty, you know, a guy who's made critical plays at critical times or whatever, and I think they're well coached. I'm a big a lot of faith in Steve Belichick. You know, every team out there, college and pro, is trying to find some way to graft Bill Belichick's DNA onto their program. Like, you know, like the University of Arizona hired what is his name? He was the quarterback's coach in 2020, halfway through the year, they hired him to be their head coach. I'm flaking on his name, just because he had been in a room with Belichick. Well, how many rooms do you think Steve Belichick has been in? You know what I mean? And by the way, at some point, the Cleveland Browns are going to hire a half-eaten sandwich that they fished out of Belichick's wastebasket and just go, okay, here it is, this sub is going to be our new head coach. Well, we don't have to do that because we've got a guy who shares a brain with him and is just a younger version of him. So I'm very bullish on this team, Kevin. And that's not a positive opinion. You look around and everyone just, you mention them and people kind of do that thing like when you ask your boss for Friday of a long weekend off, like just kind of close their eyes and just slowly shake their head disapprovingly. Well, Patriots fans, especially those of you who were chanting for Bailey Zappi last year over Mac Jones, you are my people, but be better, okay? Enjoy this. Be optimistic. Don't be Jets fans.
You know, time always flies when you and I are together and we're having fun talking about sports, talking about the Bruins game.
WATD FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD.